Welcome to the podcast, Winning Through Culture, where we're helping entrepreneurs stay impactful and relevant. I'm your host, Tim Flanagan.
I'm joined today by Neil Peterson for part two of our discussion on the power of the human spirit and the dialogue of racial discrimination in the world today. Neil and I are going to pick up right where we left off on the topic of racial injustice and discrimination.
Before we started the podcast, you and I were catching up a little bit. I do think it would be good. You know, we are in early June 2020. The issue of racial discrimination is very much in the national conversation here in the United States, and it seems like in other parts of the world. And, you know, a big part of your story is having to overcome some of that, and a lot of it in some instances to achieve your dream. It's a topic, I think, Neil, to a certain extent, that some people are uncomfortable talking about. I know I've struggled at times for the words, but it's something we do need to talk about as a society. And, you know, how from your perspective of both being, having grown up in apartheid South Africa, traveling the world, meeting all kinds of people, you know, what do you see as the situation and perhaps some of the path forward?
Well, again, this is a global conversation. This is not just an American conversation or a South African conversation. Yes, I grew up in apartheid, and I got caught up in the 1976 troubles, the Soweto uprising, when my family fled South Africa. My mother was a political activist. And 1980, when I entered high school, we got caught in the student uprising, where the police showed up at our schools, and we were doing the class sit-ins and protesting, but we were protesting peacefully. But when the police showed up, they brought their dogs, they brought their riot gear, they tear gassed us, and things turned ugly very, very fast. So I've seen how on the front end in South Africa, how these things have come to be. And when I look at the United States, a country that I immigrated to, I'm an American citizen and a South African citizen. And so I've been very closely following American politics for over 30 years. And my mother, she was educated in the United States. She was the first woman of color from South Africa to go to university in the United States. And she graduated in 1948, when very few women attended university, even in the United States. And she walked with people like Paul Robeson in the civil rights conversation that took place in the States. And she came back to South Africa to participate in the South African change of from apartheid to a true democracy. And we still have work to do here in South Africa in the economic divide and the leadership divide that is a result of apartheid. So it's an ongoing conversation. But my mom wrote a series of articles about what is happening in African Americans in the United States. And she predicted that they would be left out of society. And I had not actually read the articles, but I've heard my mom speak about her work and those articles, and then Brown University uncovered those articles, and actually about 2 or 3 years before my mom died, came to South Africa, and she was in her late 80s, to ask her, how did she have that vision? And the bottom line is, in the United States, we really have to understand culture. We really have to understand that there are people who came from this continent in Africa and went to the United States not voluntarily. I left here on a boat voluntarily, but I did not leave in shackles. And so we have that era of what happened in slavery that we haven't addressed. And no, there are people who have been descendants of slaves but have not lived under slavery. But unfortunately, we have to still remember the culture of where and how things came upon. And that education has to be given equally across the board. We can't have rich neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. And we cannot have these situations where the economics are driven by based upon what you know and where you live and where you work. We've got to come back to this place of equality. We have so many people, if we look at statistics, and we've got to look at the numbers, we have so many people who are incarceration because of various things. Why are they there? What happened? And look at the racial components of these things. I think the statistics are going to tell us some very bleak pictures on how we have to look at this conversation. And if we want to really come down and make a difference, we can't afford to have a finger pointing, but we have to recognize what brought us to where we are. And as we look right now at the police teams, those cities where the police chiefs came out to listen to the protesters. If you look at Chris Swanson up in the Minneapolis area, or I can't remember the other police chief, I think it was Jackson, but there were two police chiefs who took off their riot gear, who walked out to the protesters and said, "I hear you." And the protesters said, "Well, walk with us." And when people start to walk together, we can start to solve these things. We don't need our politicians sort of sitting in their gilded offices and being disconnected and out of touch with what is happening, or going for photo ops and exasperating. We need true leadership here. And the communities need to be heard. And not every cop is a bad cop. Not every person on the street is a rioter. There's a big difference between being a protester and being a rioter. And so we've got to start putting things into the right perspective of we need a dialogue. And people have to start becoming adults in the room. We cannot allow our emotions to get the better of us. Yes, we're going to be looking at things from different perspectives. But let's be heard about our perspectives. We can't lock into our ideology and say, "I'm right and everybody else is wrong." Because not everybody walks in the right shoes and doesn't walk a mile in the other person's shoes to really know how much does it hurt. So it is, let's start walking in those shoes, but let's also start to hold people accountable. When we have cops who are putting a chokehold and police, they have a dangerous job, they have a difficult job, but you must remember, they signed up for this job. They came to serve and to protect. So we have to hold them accountable to that element of serving and protecting and make it possible that they can do their job, but they have to also understand that they are here to protect us. So they have to recognize and listen to us, the citizens. And things like the chokeholds, things like knees on somebody's throat when they say, "I can't breathe," or deliberately targeting journalists with pepper spray, or deliberately shooting the rubber bullets at heads or below the waistline to injure people. This is not acceptable behavior. So it comes down to, we have to establish what is the rules of engagement. How do we disagree, but can find the ability to do it respectfully? We have to look at the mental health situation and see how does that come into play, because how many people are mentally challenged because of whatever reason, that and they don't think rationally as you and I do. So we've got to find, how do we protect our community in a sane and civil way? And the militarization of the police force since the 9/11 attacks, that is not the answer. That is not the way for us to be going. Look at, for a long time, the British Bobby. They walked the street, and if you got lost, you asked the Bobby for directions. You didn't fear the Bobby. You saw that Bobby as one of the people in your community, as part of your community. And I really think we've got to investigate how we can become a civil society, how we can respect the rule of law. And that rule of law starts at the very top. It starts with leadership in every aspect of the American government. And there cannot be two sets of rules, one for people with money and one for people without money, one for people who have political power and one for others who don't. So we have a long, long conversation ahead. And if you don't like where things are, if you don't like what's happening in your community, you can't just sit there and complain. We've got to get out there and find political candidates, find leaders, and put them into the places that they can do what we believe and expect of them. So again, we've got to become active in the rights of democracy. That means we've got to vote. We've got to be a part of the voice. The United States has some of the lowest voter participation, and young people, the millennials, again, among some of the worst of the track record of getting out there and voting. But they have the longest to live with the consequences of these things. And we really have to look at the municipal level. And I worked with the National League of Cities as a keynote speaker, and I met just some remarkable city councillors and mayors who really have the heart of their community and are committed to their community. But then I've seen some of these folks have gone up into the federal level and forgotten where they've come from. Somehow we can't lose sight of our roots. And when we come down to the aspect of the police, those police officers report to a police chief. That police chief is appointed by the community. And so that police chief also works with a prosecutor. So the city council and the mayors are elected officials. Prosecutors are elected officials. So we have to start holding the bosses of these police accountable of how do we want our community to function. And we truly have to get our police force engaging in the conversation with the community over what are the challenges we're going to solve and who's going to take what responsibility for solving that. We can do this together. We don't have to have a them or us. And I believe we will see a change in how crime is shifting. And we are seeing, again, the demographics and the statistics are showing that crime is decreasing. But yet we are spending more money on police budgets and less money on education, on our youth, on our healthcare system.
Obviously, as listening to you and knowing from my own personal experience, this is a complicated topic, I guess would be one way to put it, Neil. And yet it's clearly one that's time has come to be addressed, certainly here in America. And to your point, I think this is a world issue. I've talked to a lot of people the last 3 weeks and before, specifically on the topic of racial injustice, racial discrimination in our community here in Charlotte. From your perspective, the thing that strikes me, and I'll share this with you, and I'm curious as to your perspective, and I actually had a conversation with someone last night about this. I think that in the past, you know, listening to you talk, a lot of people struggle with a political position on a topic. They struggle with their own life experience. And what's missing from the conversation is, you know, Stephen Covey had in his 7 Habits, seek first to understand, then be understood. And as I've had a different conversation over the last few weeks and spent more time listening than trying to, in essence, assert my own opinion about things. There's a real humanity behind this that I think gets lost in the media, gets lost by our politicians, that we are all humans created equally. And, you know, I think, you know, my faith guides me. You know, we were told to love our neighbors as ourselves. And yeah. I don't want to say it's that simple because it's clearly not that easy. Where is the conversation, if you will, of humanity in this discussion of effectively equality and justice for all? Where do you see that?
We have that in our American Constitution, and we have our First Amendment, the right of free speech. And I look back at my history here in South Africa. I look at Nelson Mandela. He was an activist who started out in a non-violent, but because he wasn't being heard, he escalated and eventually he turned to violence as a way of attracting attention. I disagree with the methods, but I can understand the desperation that people come to. And he ended up going to Robben Island and he spent 27 years incarcerated, 27 years of being abused. And when he came out of jail, he spoke about the power of forgiveness. He spoke truly to the human spirit of, yes, you can take away a person from their freedom, but when they truly believe in freedom inside of themselves, you can never totally chain up that belief in freedom. So much to the point that when he was inaugurated as president of South Africa, he had his jailer actually present as part of moving forward. And so here is someone who's a beacon of hope, someone who came from very hard situations, but was rational and not only spoke about forgiveness, but practiced the forgiveness. But in order to get to this place, we have to acknowledge what are the challenges. And unfortunately, not every person in this planet is born equal. I have experienced not just prejudice in South Africa, I've experienced prejudice in the United States. I directly experienced prejudice in some countries, but I also look at it from the perspective of where is that person coming from? And they're coming from a place of fear. When you fear something, you reject that. So I can exasperate the prejudice and escalate the fear or de-escalate. So I think we all have to start to dig inside of ourselves and say, what are we going to do to de-escalate? And when you look at children, children are not born prejudiced. They are taught prejudice. This is a learned behavior. And so we have to come to this place of that conversation with our kids of what do we expect of our kids? It doesn't matter what somebody looks like or the economic station. We all are in a place to help each other. And so it starts with our community. It starts inside of our homes. It starts with having self-respect and respecting the leaders in our community, respecting our parents, respecting the wisdom. We have to come back to this place of where we respect knowledge. Who has the best knowledge? What can we learn from those persons? There's a reason why you are an insurance executive and I'm a sailor. I need you to use your expertise to advise me on what I do. And if you come into the water, you trust my expertise as that sailor to do my job. But it's all built upon the trust. So we've got to create that environment of the trust. And when we can start talking to our neighbors in a civil way and agree to disagree, but to look at it from the other perspective of, explain to me what is that you're so afraid of? Why are you so entrenched in that idea or that ideology? And when we can start to break through that on a neighborly community basis, we can start to move up and work on these bigger issues. But we have to have that starting point, and that starting point has to be rooted in that entity of respect and trust. And the concept of democracy, there is a place for democracy, but there isn't a place for democracy either. When I look at my sailing, and when I'm racing a full crew boat, as skipper of the boat, I have proven to be in that role of leadership as skipper of that boat. And I brought my team on board because of their expertise in their different positions on board. So in so many ways, I've been given the trust of my team to keep them safe and to make that boat move to our destination effectively and win races. But I also have the trust and my respect for my crew that they're going to do their job. And part of that job is I look at external things around the vessel. I'm looking at the weather. I'm looking at the competition. I'm looking at where are we positioned to where do we need to go. And they are looking inward to how do they keep the boat together? How do they keep the boat going fast? But at the same time, they're also looking out to cover my back. Is there something that I missed? And I'm not offended if my crew says, hey, there's dark clouds building on the horizon. We may want to shorten down sail. I'm not offended by that. I look at that information and say, you're right. And here's what we're going to do. How are we going to do it? And we do what we are trained and we trust each other to do. So we've got to come back to this place in our community that we're going to vet leaders. And those leaders are going to serve us. We are going to put them in the power of position because they have the skills to look out for us. But if they miss something, we are also going to punish them. We are going to take them out of that position. That is why we have election cycles. And possibly even why we need to consider term limits. But again, if we can hold our leadership accountable, then we don't need term limits. Because if you're doing a good job for the community and serving your people, then continue to do it. But the moment you are not doing that, then we need to step up to the plate and ask why. Why are you not doing what we're asking you to do? Why are you not addressing these issues? But we have to come together as people. It is not about being a Republican or being a Democrat. It's not about being a liberal or conservative. We have the same common values. We breathe the same air. We eat out of the same pots. So let's start to continue to find what it is that we have in common, because we'll discover we have more in common than actually separates us. And we can get through this.
I've enjoyed spending time with you on this episode today, and be sure to continue along this winning journey with me. Thank you for listening to the Winning Through Culture podcast. And remember, stay impactful and relevant. To connect with us, you can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Winning Through Culture, and find us online at winningthroughculture.com, or just go to the show notes where you'll find all the links. We look forward to connecting with you and hearing from you. Thanks for listening.